Europe on Air.
Europe on Air.
Europa por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour program looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday, 4:30 to 5 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Europe on Air. My name is Paul Loughran, and on today's programme, we are asking the question, what is Irish culture? I've got three guests in the studio with me. I'm joined by Katie Lowry of the Creative Europe Desk Ireland. I'm joined by Mark O'Brien, who is the Acting Director of Axis Ballymun. And finally, I'm joined with Jim Carroll of the Irish Times. So I guess to get things started today, we'll kind of look a little bit at what traditionally Ireland would have been known from a cultural point of view. So we have stuff like literature, Patrick Kavanagh and James Joyce and Seamus Heaney, and we have music. Traditionally, it would be traditional music that Ireland is known for. We've got food, cabbage and potatoes, ham. We have maybe more popular music. People think of Ireland, they think of U2. People think of Ireland, they think of pubs, they think of Guinness, they think of the Fighting Irish, they think of St. Patrick's Day. Maybe they think of sport, maybe they think of hurling, Irish traditional dancing. So I'll start with Katie. You know, are these the things, you work in a job with a European context, are these the things that outsiders would think of Ireland when it comes to culture?
I think to a certain extent, there's certainly art forms within Ireland that would register kind of more widely within Europe. But certainly the clients I deal with and the projects I'm across, a lot of them would be quite contemporary in nature. So there's kind of the idea that a rural arts centre in Leitrim would partner with the rural arts centre in Sweden or Poland and actually have a lot more in common in terms of their kind of work practices and some of the challenges they face than they would with a big organization based in Dublin. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I would say that certainly with traditional arts, you say, be it dance or song, there'd be a huge kind of appetite and appreciation for it across Europe. But I would say that probably Ireland's making its mark, you know, within the kind of European art sphere, more in contemporary practices, is what I would say.
When you look at an art centre in Sweden and an art centre, say, down in Cork, for example, would it be fair to say that there isn't a huge amount of difference between the cultures of, say, Sweden and Ireland in that respect?
Or I guess I sometimes see it from maybe a different point of view. So I would say, you know, and the funding would seek to say, what are the challenges that these art centres might face? And they would be linked that way, you know, so a lot of the kind of big exchanges that happen in Europe can often happen, you know, in kind of capital cities or the usual kind of trade route, so to speak, of kind of Berlin or London or Paris. So a smaller arts organization out of that kind of context would actually need to kind of have strategies and maybe need to like leverage their capacity by working with other organizations. So I'd say they would share that. I mean, if you talk to some of the artists that I meet, they would feel that Ireland in terms of its even just geography, you know, is very unique in terms of what's developed here. So I wouldn't feel that necessarily, you know, that you would define European culture in those ways all the time, if that makes sense.
Okay. I know from our own perspective in Near FM and the Near Media Co-op, we do a lot of European partnerships. So we would have that relationship with other small community media organizations in Germany and in Spain, for example, Hungary, and we would meet people that are having the same challenges as us in terms of meeting funding and, you know, getting their message out. Mark, you work for a relatively small arts centre in Dublin. Mm-hmm. How do you find the Do you have relationships with other European countries? Do you go down that route?
Yeah, I mean, sorry, excuse me. We're kind of an arts and community resource centre in Ballymun. And what's interesting, we have toured our productions kind of both to Europe and to America. But just in relation to, so just coming back on something that was said in relation to the area of kind of culture, and a lot from your introduction, I think a lot of what's viewed internally in Ireland as Irish culture is actually very much changing in the kind of last 10 years, and I think it's kind of breaking away from the historical packaging of Irish culture in a European guise to actually looking at what is contemporary and kind of future looking. I'm not saying anything that happened before 2000 is can't be, you know, developed, but I think certainly for my kind of a lot of the work kind of musically in the last kind of 5 to 10 years has been around a whole kind of upsurge of the urban music or hip hop or rap scene in North Dublin in particular, and the whole movement away from it being an Americanization of that sound into a real kind of Dublin, I suppose a true Dublin language around that. That's very interesting, because what's transferable into a European and a US context is the American, you know, global hip hop urban rap. But actually trying to transfer even to a wider Irish context, young men in areas such as Coolock or Ballymun, Blanchardstown, Finglas, talking about their own life experiences kind of is very, very difficult in some ways. And I think that's a really interesting thing from an Irish cultural perspective, is that, you know, I think, are we really, really interested in really listening to the voices that are out there artistically in our own society at the moment?
The point on Irish hip hop and rap is quite interesting, because there almost seems to be a backlash from other musicians when if the Irish person sings in their own voice, they get criticised because it doesn't sound, you know, like a rapper should sound. But if they rap in an American voice, then it sounds, it's been criticised as being not authentic. Do you find the guys that you would meet in the Axis, maybe they're rehearsing up there or performing up there, did they come up against those challenges?
I think it's about being authentic to oneself. I mean, I think whatever art form that you're in, whether it's a rock band in a garage or whether it's a young theatre company starting out, I think there's two things that we have certainly noticed, and I think it's, you know, it's not just in Ballymun, but the fact of being authentic to what you want to explore as a young artist who is happening to live in Ireland or be from Ireland, and also that there's a kind of a pursuit for excellence in what you do. But I think the big thing that sets our Irish culture, not apart, but I think the big one of the biggest urges that we have as a nation is for inclusivity. We want to be involved. I think that's why, I mean, you mentioned before the program about kind of music. I think that's why, you know, when you go to a concert, you're involved in the concert. You can sing along, you can jump up and down. And I think that's where, certainly when we develop theatre productions or develop, you know, any sort of visual arts, could, you know, I think when people can actually actively engage with it, that's when the art kind of sings, to use a, you know, poem.
Is that why festivals are so popular in Ireland, particularly in the summertime? You know, when you look at festivals, Jim, you write a lot about culture and art and festivals on your Irish Times blog. Are festivals an Irish thing insofar as to say that we have all manner of festivals and they're in every county in Ireland, they're in every town in Ireland? Is that something that kind of comes back to Mark's point of people wanting to be included and wanting to participate in the arts?
Like, I think the growth in festivals over the last decade is particularly a Europe-wide phenomenon, to be honest. You know, I remember being in Livorno in Italy a couple of years ago at a festival there, and, like, anything you saw at the Electric Picnic, as in, like, say, the kind of, like, the breadth of activities, apart from music, readings, comic books, exhibitions, theatre, dancing, yoga, anything like that, it also happened there. So, I mean, any of those festivals we think of as uniquely Irish, they're tapping into kind of like a Europe or even a worldwide basis. This is what people want right now. They want to go out during the summertime. They want to hang out with a similar group or their social network, and they want to experience as wide a variety of kind of art practices as they possibly can. I think it's interesting what you're talking about there regarding the hip hop thing, you know, and also you're talking earlier on about, like, the art students in Leitrim finding their peers abroad as well. We seem to be kind of mistaking, I suppose, in many ways, mainstream and niche here, because I mean, if you talk to mainstream Europeans about what's Irish culture, they're going to talk about Oscar Wilde, Seamus Heaney, Guinness, U2, Riverdance. I mean, they're still still the big signifiers in terms of Irish culture, because when like when I see from kind of like, I suppose my kind of bailiwick, you know, in terms of contemporary music, there's definitely a kind of a growth there in terms of some artists. Like at the moment, a lot of people, we're talking about James Vincent McMorrow, for example, or artists like Hozier, you know. But like, again, it's very much, it's niche. It still hasn't kind of crossed over to a mainstream. So the mainstream signifiers are still the big people. And it's interesting as well. I mean, when you were speaking about like in various programs and things like that, I was thinking that one of the most successful, I suppose, music programs that's happened in Europe in the last 5 years is a jazz festival called 12 Points, and that originated here in Dublin with the Improvised Music Company. And what they do is it's almost like a traveling roadshow for jazz. Every second year it's in Dublin, and every other year it's based at a different small European city, and they bring 12 acts from all around Europe, 12 new brand new jazz acts to play in these kind of centres. And it's really interesting that came about through the efforts of a Dublin promoter, and I'd like to see more examples of that happening, because one thing that people kind of seem to forget is that Europe has money. It's not loaded, but it has money. Yeah. And like another, like when I was talking there about James Vincent McMorrow and Hozier, one very successful way they've got into Europe on the European festival circuit this year is a program called the European Talent Exchange Program, ETEP, which basically is run out of a festival called Eurosonic in Groningen, which happens every January. And what the ETEP program does is it takes promising acts and basically gets them on the festival circuit Europe-wide. It's also sponsored by the European Broadcasting Union, which means when the acts play, aside from getting a fee, they also get exposure from media as well. It's really, really valuable. And I'm fascinated by like why we're a nation of great talkers. That why aren't people like, instead of cribbing and complaining about like, I mean, the pithy amounts they're getting from the Arts Council, sure, or Culture Ireland, whatever, why aren't they looking kind of like to Europe? It seems to be a historical thing, you know, that like, I mean, we've always looked to either that big country beside us, Britain, or we've looked to the States. We've always ignored Europe. Is it a language barrier? Is it the fact that we don't eat baguettes? You know what I mean? It's like it's one of those things that's fascinated me for as long as I've been involved in writing about and talking about music and arts and culture. Why we don't look more to Europe for that sort of like help or whatever? I mean, maybe his language barrier. That seems to me the one thing which prevents stuff.
I mean, if I could just cut in.
Yeah, sure.
It's amazing, Jim. You're completely doing my job for me.
I've got this amazing ability to read over people's shoulders and read upside down, so I'm reading all your notes.
But one thing I was going to say, just in terms of maybe some of the barriers, which I think are kind of gradually being broken down. When I first started in the role in about 2009, we just did a kind of informal survey about people's attitude towards EU funding and why they're not going for it. And actually, in some ways, we're at a geographic disadvantage, and that's a very real, you know, thing, because really how you kind of make the partnerships required to, you know, mount a big European project like Jerry. Now, it's not to say that this is kind of insurmountable, because it's not. But in people's mind, this was a big thing. I think sometimes language can be a thing. But then it's very interesting, because if you look at who Irish people partner with, like Jerry Godley didn't partner with the UK on that project. You know what I mean? It was kind of Portugal and another country. And if you actually look at who Ireland partners with, a lot of times it's not who you expect. So it would go kind of Eastern Europe or Scandinavia. The other thing is actually the cost. So it is kind of, cost can be prohibitive to mounting one. But I do think now, as the funding landscape has changed, more and more people are looking to Europe and actually seeing the opportunities there. And I think we will see more and more projects coming out.
Can I just pick up on something that Jim said? Certainly, I think we are a nation of talkers, but maybe we're not a nation of form fillers. And and to access European funding and the type of revenue you need to tour Europe as a musician, you also need to be able to, and some of the staff in NIR know acutely, the amount of detail, and Katie will attest to this, the amount of detail that you need to put into these European applications. And for maybe just for a musician who's on their own, or it's just a band but they've no manager, or they've no one advising them, they look at these forms and they go, ah, forget about it, I can't fill that in, there's just too much detail required. Is that prohibitive, do you think?
I think to a certain extent I might accept that, because I mean it is a kind of bureaucratic process, but usually the money involved is quite substantial. I think the thing is about Europe is they believe that everything can be quantified, and they will lay out exactly what you need to provide. They will lay out, you know, exactly the points you're going to get for A, B, and C. So I think it's probably a question of, you know, educating yourself as well. Mm. And actually the organizations here have probably an infrastructure that in some ways is still quite small. You know, capacity is an issue, but they're very developed compared to some of their European counterparts who might be getting the funding. So I always try to say to people, there is the expertise here, but maybe this is going to sound a bit wishy-washy, but maybe it's a confidence thing sometimes as well.
It's also kind of a feeling as well. Like, you're definitely right. Like, Katie, the expertise is definitely there, you know? But like, there's also kind of like that Irish thing of, I mean, we're on radio, so I can't do a visual thing. Like, people remember being in exams, you put your arm around the paper to make sure no one can look over. And I find there's often a case with that with arts organisations here in Ireland, that they know how much they can get and they're damned if they're going to let anyone else in on their nest egg, you know? And I feel that's definitely something to, that's a part of it as well.
I think that is major. It's changing because it has to, because the funding landscape has, you know, and is radically altering. But what I've always found bizarre in the many years of being involved in the arts in different kind of guises is that for what at heart is a kind of collaborative process, collaboration and partnerships can be very, very difficult in the arts. And I don't think that's actually really talked about. And I think it's down to confidence. I actually do think if someone has a piece of the pie, they want to keep their piece of the pie, and they haven't quite got around to that if we actually joined the pies, we've got two big pies, because I was like, well, who'll own that then? Actually, it will happen. you know, and I think that's the thing. And I think, you know, that certainly towards, you know, partnering towards any type of application. I love the point of when conversations are at the point of, like, you know, dreaming, and it's great. But then when you sit down and you kind of go, okay, let's all put that on the page, half the room leaves. But then you are left with the people who actually want to take the time to kind of put it down. But I do think there is a thing about collaborating, which is really difficult at times.
I think there's such a tradition even if you looked within the Arts Council and their kind of long-standing travel and training award, how many artists have, or the Arts Flight as it was called, you know, have traveled to Europe, do kind of partner and exchange. And I think that, again, is something that will stand to Irish organisations here. But it's like the process of having to formalise and agree budgets and realise you're kind of going to be, for lack of a better term, in bed with these people for 3 years. Yeah. You know, the year that you make the application unpaid, you know, the 2 years running the project and probably the year winding it up. So it is. You're right. It's kind of.
Would you think though that's just changing? Do you mean, like, you know, as we're kind of like maturing, as arts organisations are maturing and begin to realise that, like, we getting money from the national purse is going to be very, very hard. Are they going to becoming more mature about that and realising, like, when we have to kind of partner, we have to kind of grow up, and we have to collaborate better? I mean, is that happening with you? Is that happening?
I think it is happening, and I think it happened first and foremost because of lack of resources. But I think once people started doing it, they went, oh, actually, this is fun. Do you know what I mean? You can do more.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's kind of gone from the language of trying to do more with less, which I hate. You know, it's kind of, you know, we keep shrinking things, but do more, do the same. Yeah. Yeah. Actually going, well, actually, well, if our less plus your less equals, you know, the same amount of money. And I think, I don't know whether it's a particularly Irish thing or not, but it's like the refusal to look at things that are actually happening. They're trying to ignore it. I know, it's fine. It's fine. I'm gonna keep this bit, and the little chip goes away next year. Oh, it's fine. I can see. Until you kind of go, oh, holy God, I'm kind of left with this, and scrabbling around for partners, which people can smell a mile away as well. Yeah. You know. So I think the younger generation, particularly in the performing arts, there's a younger generation of theatre companies and producers that are completely au fait with Europe, having travelled.
Yeah,
and I think themselves having gone there, you know, directly after school or college, being eating baguettes in Italy and just kind of coming home and kind of going, well, I met this guy there and he runs this. And so it suddenly becomes natural, which I think we have a huge advantage because of our great conversational, you know, is that, like, if, you know, we're great at meeting people. So if you're away on holidays or if you're away on, I think we kind of up till now didn't realise these people actually work here.
Yeah.
So when you're away in Paris on your holiday, knock on the door and kind of go, you know what I do.
It's like globalisation has broken down the walls. I mean, years ago, if an artist went abroad, be it Joyce, Beckett, Bacon, it was like they were in exile. Now, if you're going to go abroad, you're just working for a while, you're going to come back. You're going to come back loads of ideas, loads of contacts, and loads of context.
Yeah, and you can, and I think it's in all fields. It's not just in literature anymore. It is touring theatre companies. It's musicians.
It's definitely visual artists as well. I mean, any of the exhibitions I've been to see lately in Emma, any of the retrospectives, like being Patsy Scott, and then the woman whose name I can't remember, the architect, what was her name, Gray?
Eileen Gray.
Thank you very much, Eileen Gray. Like, if you look at their CVs and where they've worked, I mean, Europe-wide, it's just incredible. I mean, Patrick Scott in particular was just like, he was all over Europe. I mean, it's something like, I mean, we've been able to do this for a long time, but now that there's money there, we should be able to do it even better.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I was just going to say, you know, I guess in my official capacity, you know, the idea for the EU is that they believe there is a kind of a common geographic, social and cultural space that is Europe. You know, so the projects they fund are based on that idea. And it's like Jim was saying, there are especially young artists coming out and they're actually embodying that idea. And they don't have the kind of borders or maybe parochialism, you know, that some might have had. So I think I would be broadly optimistic about.
Can I ask you a question now that you've got your official hat on? Have they defined what this space is? Have they actually defined what this social and cultural common space is?
It's the member states, the accession. I mean, they would say it's a very real geographic term. Now, for the purposes of EU funding, it would be the member states and the accession states. And then in addition to that, even countries that have signed memorandum, so say Georgia and Armenia,
right? And is there commonality? Have they recognized a kind of like a sense of commonality between them?
I guess to look at it from the other side, what do they want to achieve? So they would see a lot of the, you know, kind of funding programs come out of a very high level, say treaty objective. So they would say a big one now, you know, coming out of, I guess, or being in the recession, would be that culture's capacity to promote jobs and growth, things like that. But another one, which I think is probably the even higher one.
You shouldn't use the dreaded word bed nights.
I know. No. But it's, you know, the idea that culture can promote international relations, that culture, you know, cultural diversity and intercultural dialogue will actually kind of create a sustained kind of peace and social integration. So it's I guess, it's coming from that point of view. What do they want to achieve? So they don't want to fund anything that could be achieved purely at a national level. So that's what I guess I mean by a European space. So when you have a European project, it's got to be constant kind of exchange and movement across borders. Mm-hmm. That didn't answer it at all, did it?
No,
it didn't.
Can we bring it back to I guess to our original question, and what is Irish culture? You know, Jim, do you think, like, what is Irish culture is changing? Like, what you perceive to be Irish culture is changing?
I mean, the Irish culture has always been to me, like, I mean, whatever's been produced here of an artistic or cultural bent that reflects what's going on in the country. And, like, it's fascinating. I mean, it's as wide and broad. But then again, like, I mean, if you were talking to a Belgian Jim Carroll right now, he would be kind of like saying something similar. That, I mean, Belgian culture incorporates all these things. I'm fascinated by the dovetail between what we regard as Irish culture, i.e. everything that is basically produced here that reflects what's going on in this country, or reflects maybe like our dreams of what this country should be about, or even in some ways cynically reflects what we think is going, what was going on, like also like how this kind of like works in a European context. You know, I mean, is there such a thing as a Europe-wide culture? You know, and again, it's a much bigger and broader question. It's also like, I mean, it's endemic in the political ecosystem right now. You know, especially after the results of the last round of European elections. Like, what is Europe? Like, I mean, where is this great idea of that Europe was in the post-war years? Is that now disappeared? Is that now null and void? In terms of Irish culture, though, I mean, no, it's just you mentioned at the very, very start of the program, like everything from kind of like, you know, hurling to like bacon and cabbage, you know. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, culture, that's part of our cultural makeup here. The Catholic Church is part of our cultural makeup, whether we accept that or not. It is, because it's had a huge effect on kind of like, I mean, so many decades of this country and what's happened there. And it's just this huge area of kind of like, I mean, shared things we share in common by virtue of the fact that we live and work and we're born in this particular country.
I think it's an interesting thing, and it constantly comes up in the area of the arts and culture about, like, you know, what is the arts and what is the culture?
Because
I think
even today we've discussed both, but not specifically.
Yeah, where is the kind of the line between both? I mean, I think you can talk about culture absolutely in that widest field, but like, if you were to talk about that in relation to an artistic kind of project to apply for artistic funding, it's interesting. You can't apply to kind of make the best bacon and cabbage in Ireland, but you could apply to make an amazing sculpture based upon bacon and cabbage in Ireland. And I think that I think it's a really interesting question, because like I'm involved in the periphery, like sort of campaigning for the arts and the arts funding, and my kind of hobby horse that I always kind of bang on it. Like, I think people inside the arts get the value of the arts. They absolutely do. People outside the arts, not so much, until you actually let people know what the arts actually are.
Yeah.
So they range from their 7-year-old kid singing on the way home from school to them on their iPad watching the latest, you know, series of The House of Cards to the cinema, to the theatre. And suddenly if you start saying, my thing is about actually, you know, if you actually sort of pretended to ban the art, ban creativity for a day, you'd soon get to the nub of what actually your culture is. So you couldn't read a book, you couldn't sing in the chair, you couldn't listen to the radio, that to me is how, you know, my belief is culture is us. I mean, there's nothing else that you can say isn't culture.
Yeah.
And then the arts is the expression of part of that, the way hurling is the expression of another part of it.
And it's also,
No, I was just going to say, I guess the missing piece that, you know, really needs to be discussed is the idea of audience and the experience of the arts. And that's, you know, again, to kind of talk about EU funding and how do you make the case, like that's what they're very concerned with. They don't want to fund, you know, Access Ballymun. They want to fund who you reach you can reach. And so that's another thing. So sometimes it's like you can sit here and talk about what is culture, but actually it's probably being molded and defined, like you were saying, by, you know, your hip hop group or who's actually driving, you know, what we want to kind of.
It's interesting to use the word creativity as well, because I mean, what I often find in these conversations, what people forget about is the value inherent in actually knowing how to do something. You're talking about there, about a 7-year-old singing on his way home from school. He can sing, he can make him play guitar, and that's a talent he's going to have for as long as he lives, maybe 40, 50, 60, 70 years. And it's a talent that's going to bring great joy to him. And once he learns how to play it properly, other people around him as well. But like, it's one of those things we often forget about. We often look at the monetary value, we often look at kind of like the bed nights value of arts and culture. But like the actual like human value as well. I think it is every year around when there's this thing called Love Live Music. This day of Love Live Music is on, and I just kind of, it's amazing. It makes me think how many musicians are in Dublin. I spent a lot of time in the States and cities like Detroit and New Orleans, and they basically, their music, you know, those cities are full of music. But here in Dublin, we kind of like, we downplay it. And if you think about it and try and do a census of how many musicians are in Dublin, be it like trad players who turn up in the pub once a week,
it's phenomenal.
It's a phenomenal number. And it's one of those things that, like, to me, is like, you know, that's something that we should be kind of like looking at and doing more about.
I just come in on that, because I'm a musician myself, and I would play in Dublin, and I see the amount of, every night of the week you can go to a bar in Dublin and there's not just live music but live original music, and really good live original music being played for free by the musicians, and some of the time the musicians have to pay themselves to just rent the room so that they can express themselves in a good venue, and it really is phenomenal. And not just rock music, it's every genre, electronica, acoustic, folk, traditional, every genre you can think of, and there's musicians excelling. And I guess there is, if there was any slight place where maybe the arts aren't being recognised enough, it's probably in music, where I think Dubliners particularly are excelling at the moment. Sorry, Mark, you were going to come
in.
I
mean, on the day the World Cup starts, I think there's something, we always, when I'm kind of talking about this type of stuff, because I use the sports analogy, like, the 7-year-old boy or girl is playing the same sport, kicking the ball against the wall, as Lionel Messi or Ronaldo. Yeah. No one's saying that the 7-year-old is as good as Messi or Ronaldo. They may, if they keep practicing, get a career for themselves, or they may just stay out their back garden having fun. But no one also is saying that them playing football damages Messi or Ronaldo's reputation by playing football. And I think lingering in the arts is this kind of sense that people doing things not professionally or like doing it for their enjoyment somehow damages
people that are
the excellence of this of this end.
Yeah.
And I think that it goes back to the whole thing about putting your hand across the kind of copybook. In theatre, like the amount of people who are involved in amateur drama companies all across the country. And no one's saying like an amateur drama company production is as good as whatever, you know, the top theatre company is, but they're doing the same thing, and they're exploring for their own enjoyment the same thing, and audiences kind of go to that. So I think there's kind of a link missing there between, I think it's confidence.
We have 1 minute, so Katie, final words. Do you have any final words?
I just had maybe...
You've got 10 seconds.
Maybe an anecdote, but the head of culture at the time of the European Commission was over, and she was talking about audience. It's a new kind of priority. And what she was saying is it's about the quality of the experience. So she said you can have 2,000 people in an opera house in Vienna, but actually that's not as much worth to them in some cases. Now, this is a whole other argument. Mm-hmm. As possibly a smaller, you know, venue in Dublin that might actually, the dreaded participatory arts or theatre. Mm. So I think the nature from the European, you know, how they define audience and how they define quality and all of that is probably more attractive to a lot of Irish arts organisations here than they might believe, mm-hmm. and actually more applicable. So
Jim?
That's my pitch.
Any final words?
Final words. Oh, God, I can't think of anything. This room's like a sauna. Do you need to apply to some Marston for air conditioning?
I'd just like to apologise for our broken fan.
I've had more to add. No, I haven't. I mean, it's been a wide-ranging discussion, and it's definitely covered a lot of areas. But I think the fact that, like, Mark brought up as well, is like, it's just that kind of so snobbery between the paid-for and the actual, like, enjoyment thing as well is something that has to go. Because, I mean, you also got to remember that if you poll an awful lot of tourists coming to Ireland for culture, they will actually say as well that the amateur playing in pubs, the amateur playing in trad stations, okay, is something which attracts them as well.
Yeah. Jim, I've been told to stop, so just quickly, I want to thank my guests. We probably should have done this over an hour rather than half. I'd like to thank Katie Lowry, I'd like to thank Mark O'Brien, I'd like to thank Jim Carroll. Thank you very much for joining us. Coming up next week on Europe on Air, we have the topic is climate change. Coming up next on Near FM is Mad Scientist of Music, which is produced by Gareth Stack. And on this week's programme, very, very quickly, if bear with me one sec, it's called Toys, Taking Toys Apart, and he'll be looking at Gamepack Collective, Andrew Edgar, Mark QVR, John Leach, and Genesis of Dublin's Finest Chiptune Collective. Finally, John demonstrates the dark art of cartridge ripping. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air.
Europa por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour program looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday 4:30 to 5 p.m. Europe on Air radio campaign has been financed by the European Union. The contents of the radio shows reflect only the author's views, and the Commission is not responsible for any use that may be made of the information they contain.